Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and hosted by Pearson Crutcher and Jay Healy. The Society of Entrepreneurs is a membership organization founded to promote entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to Memphis business owners.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Today's interview is with a true pioneer in Memphis media, Art Gilliam.
As the founder of Gilliam Communications, WLOK became the first Black-owned radio station in Memphis.
We hope that you'll enjoy hearing about Art's entrepreneurial journey.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. We're very excited to have Art Gilliam with us today. Welcome, Art.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Art, I'm always happy to be in your presence, so this is exciting for me. But I know that you are the owner of WLOK Radio.
WLOK,
sorry, I got a little tongue-tied.
Easy to remember. We love our kids.
Oh, so, I have known you forever and did not know that that's what it stood for. But
Well, it used to a long time ago, so we've kind of used that sometimes to help people remember.
That's awesome. Well, can you tell us a little bit about WLOK?
Well, WLOK is a station that's been here for years and years. I mean, decades, but our company bought it in 1977. It was originally an R&B station and was for a number of years. In fact, it's the station that I listened to most when I was a teenager. So we bought the station in 1977, and it was an AM station. In fact, it was the first Black-owned AM station in Memphis, and we continued it as an AM station. And then subsequently, we added in the last 3 years an FM component, which is called the translator, which means we broadcast the same things on FM that we broadcast on AM. So WLOK is both an AM and an FM station, and then we stream on the internet so anyone can hear us anywhere. And then we have a couple of other, you know, promotional efforts that we do that are part of what we do, but not really part of the radio station itself. There are things that we've expanded into.
Have special events like Stone Soul Picnic.
Well, that's it. Yeah, the WLOK Stone Soul Picnic is a special event, and we've actually been doing that. It has started before we started the station by a year or two, but we continued it, and it kind of became a tradition for us, and so we've been doing that. And it's an event, as you know, that's out in the park, and it's a free event. So it's really a thank you event, you know, for our listeners. So we're letting our listeners know we appreciate, you know, that they listen to WLOK. So we more recently have done it at Levitt Shell for about the last 5 years. And prior to that, we were in Tom Lee Park. So that's one of the offsprings, I guess you could say, of WLOK Radio.
Very good. Now, I just want to clarify, because you said it was I know that it's the first Black-owned radio station, but that's when you bought it. It wasn't prior to that, was it?
No, it was not.
Okay,
right.
That's
so, when we bought the station, our company and I, the principal shareholders of the company, so when we bought the station, it became the first Black-owned station in Memphis. It also became, at the time, the first locally-owned station in Memphis. A lot of people don't know that, but I guess it made more impact in so far as the aspect of being the first Black-owned station.
Sure. Now, did you grow up in Memphis?
I did. Our family moved here when I was very young, but I grew up in Memphis from about 6 years old and went to Hamilton High School.
All right, very good.
In those days, high schools were from, you know, all from first grade to 12th grade.
Oh, really? So you were the same place all 12 years?
Well, yeah, I didn't actually go to Hamilton for the whole 12 years. I came here, I wasn't in the first grade, but I left Hamilton in the 10th grade, so I was there for about 8 or 9 years.
And then you left there to go?
I went to school in Connecticut. It was a school just outside of Hartford, Connecticut, in a small community called Simsbury. And at that time, as you may know, or a lot of people don't remember, but Memphis was a very segregated community at that time, very different than it is today. A lot of people today don't realize what the community was like back in those years and in the 60s, 50s, and 60s. But in any case, my parents elected to send me away to school, and I went to Connecticut to a place called Westminster School outside of Hartford.
Are you an only child?
I am.
Well, that must have been hard for them to let you go.
Well, I guess more for my mom than it was for my dad, I think, in a way, because he sort of had a vision that I really needed to leave. And again, it's a consequence of the South and, you know, the way things were at that time. But his view was that I really should get outside the South. But, you know, for my mom, it was, I think, a lot more emotional to have me leave at that. And I was left at a very young age. I was about 12 years old when I left to go to the school. Yeah, and I was ahead of myself in school. Was it at that?
I was going to say you're 12 and you're like in the 10th grade.
Well, yeah, I was entering the 10th grade. Back in those days, wow. they would give you, probably haven't heard of it now in the current times, but back in those days, they'd give you a test, and the test would determine what grade you should be in. So they would place you in the grade that corresponded to what you scored on the test. So when we moved here from Nashville, Tennessee, I took a test, and they placed me in the fourth grade, and I was 6 years old. So
Oh my gosh.
I was quite a bit ahead.
Yes, you certainly were. Wow.
So how old were you when you went to college then?
Well, when I went to college, I was 16 because I spent an extra year actually at Westminster.
Okay.
They thought I was a little too far ahead. and so I spent an extra year there, and I was actually 16 when I entered Yale University.
16, still young.
Yeah, it was young. Well, I was younger than my classmates, than my roommates when I went to college, yes.
And you went to Yale.
So I did.
You excellent education.
My dad, I guess somehow he read that Yale was a great place to go. So he had always instilled that in me from the time I was young. Now, it just happened that I was able to be qualified to go to Yale. I don't know that he had that thought, whether I would be qualified to be admitted, you know, into Yale. But yes, for a long period of time, he had that sort of vision, I guess. And so, yeah.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. That's a real benefit for you, for sure.
Did you come right back to Memphis after school?
No, I went to graduate school. So I went to the University of Michigan graduate school, and I got a master's in actuarial science. Said previously, some people don't know what actuarial science is, and I don't think when I first heard of it, I knew either, but it's insurance mathematics. And so I got a master's in business administration with a specialty in actuarial science.
And what did that lead to?
That led me to coming back to Memphis because my dad worked with an insurance company, Universal Life Insurance Company, which is a large business at that time. We were in the South where, you know, things were very separate, and Universal was one of the largest bike businesses in the country. And in fact, even in the world, it had tens of millions of dollars in assets, and it was an insurance company. And so as a result, with my specialty in actuarial science, which I think is what my father had envisioned at the time, that was what I did. I came back and started working at the insurance company.
And when did you came back, did you find Memphis had changed for the better, for the worse?
Well, it had changed some, but it's in the context that I came back a little bit before Dr. King was killed here. So there was turmoil. And so, yeah, no, Memphis had changed, you know, from the standpoint of when I was a youngster, but it had not changed to anywhere near the kind of city we know it to be today. So while it had changed some, we were still yet to go through the worst of the elements that led to major change.
Yes, for sure. Things definitely changed then, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So tell us the journey from insurance science or
actuarial science,
actuarial science to owning a radio station.
Boy, well, it's not a straightforward path, I can tell you that much. Yeah. The first thing was that I had always been interested in writing, and I came back, and then shortly after I got back, Dr. King was killed here in Memphis, but there was no expression of Black viewpoints in the Commercial Appeal newspaper at that time. And I approached the Commercial Appeal. The editor was a fellow named Frank Algren, and I indicated to him basically that I was interested in writing a column that would express a Black point of view because there was no such expression. And then and also the paper, I mean, there was a lot of tension, racial tension in Memphis at the not to say there's that some today as well, but there was really a tremendous amount of tension at that time. And there were boycotts. I think the paper was even being considered for possibility of boycotting because they didn't have expressions of Black points of view. So in any event, so to answer your question, that was my first foray, I guess you could say, into media, was writing a column in the Commercial Appeal. And I wrote the column for some months, and Channel 5, WMC-TV, contacted me about the possibility of working in television, which I had never thought about. I mean, so, I mean, from my point of view, I was in the insurance business, and that's what I was planning on doing. I hadn't had any thought necessarily getting into electronic media. But they talked to me about it, and I told them I'm in insurance, don't really have an interest in getting in television. But then they wanted me to do weekend anchor. So that was something I could do. And I became a weekend anchor on Channel 5. So I did the 6 and 10 o'clock news on Saturdays.
You know, or I just want to ask you personally, because that's a brave thing that you did at a very It was a tense time.
Yeah.
And for you to do that, was that a scary, I mean, and you were obviously young, just talking about when you went to college and everything. So was it a scary time?
Well, you mean in terms of just
speaking
my
out, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I got a lot of nasty letters, sure. There's no question about it. And I think that it was a time where, you know, I really presented a point of view, and it was carried as an op-ed in the Commercial Appeal that had not been presented before. So I got letters, they got letters. I mean, so yes. But as far as being afraid, no, I didn't feel afraid. But I definitely, there was tension, just given where Memphis was at that time in terms of just race relations.
Do you feel it had an impact, your work?
I definitely feel it had an impact. And a lot of the response that we get, especially in the Black community, you know, just the fact of having some expression. And then in particular on television, because I was the first Black anchor actually on television. So that got a huge response. And the general manager of the radio station, his name's Mari Greiner, he said the Saturday night news was the highest rated news on the station. It's not because I was great, it was because I was Black. Because nobody has seen a Black reporter. But in any case.
A big audience.
Yeah, but it had a big audience. So it had some impact, just the fact of having a Black face on television. Because, you know, today it's commonplace. But at that time, you know, if you can imagine, for example, a University of Memphis basketball team without any Black players, I mean, or, let alone a Black coach. I mean, that's the kind of society we were living in at that time. So, yes, it had some impact.
Did you ever think that you'd be one of those people that was breaking barriers and that?
No. I mean, that wasn't the goal of mine specifically. I mean, I had strong feelings about what was going on, but it was not a conscious goal of mine to break barriers. I think it's just a matter of that I happened to be there at the time and had some qualifications, you know, for it. But so someone was going to be, I guess, the first, you might say, of in terms of both the Commercial Appeal and the Channel 5. But I didn't really consciously think about it in terms of I'm breaking barriers.
Did you use WLOK also as a platform for that?
Well, no. At that time, I hadn't even, sort of like I said, it's a circuitous route from where I got from actual.
We still haven't gotten to the radio.
Yeah, still haven't gotten to the radio part. Yeah, that's right. But I began to do some things on radio, just, you know, not for compensation, just, you know, public service and that sort of thing. So I got involved and interested in the radio business, and so.
He has the perfect radio voice.
Well, I don't know, but I fortunately, I guess for that time, I guess so, and hopefully now as well. But in any case, I did get into doing some radio, and I found that I liked radio a lot more than I liked television, personally. I mean, just, I guess it's a personal thing more so, but I enjoyed the radio a lot, and I had in my mind at some point, I got into the idea of possibly owning a radio station or purchasing a radio station and putting together the funds to do that. So ultimately, I went to Washington. I left the insurance business, left the television business, and went to Washington, D.C., and worked with the first Black congressman who was there, Harold Ford Sr. So I worked there for about a year and a half, and then I got really particularly interested while I was there because you may remember, some will remember Benjamin Hooks, who was the first Black commissioner for the FCC, and Ben was from Memphis. And so when I was there, I kind of sought some advice from him, and he sent me to a couple of places, one of being a radio broker. And the radio broker he sent me to, when I went and talked to him about my interest, he said, I just happen to have a listing of a station that's for sale in Memphis, Tennessee, which is my hometown, of course. And so, but people in Memphis didn't know the station was for sale because normally in situations like that, you're not going to reveal it to the staff or to the people in that community. So I went from there to getting more information about the station and about the possibility that it might be for sale. And so that's how I eventually wound my way from being in actuarial science around into getting into the radio business.
What'd your dad say about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My dad had passed away, and in the interim, he passed away in 1973. So before I was involved in the radio business, he had passed away. I was involved in the Commercial Appeal and with Channel 5, and he was pleased about that. But my mom was very upset, you know, at the time, because my dad had passed away. I was in insurance, and she had seen that, and she envisioned that as the career I was going to be in. And so she envisioned me as going up the, you know, to the top of the company. And in order to get into radio, it was important for me to be at different parts of the country when things were going on because of the nature of the way the station was being sold and the company that was selling it. I had to be where I needed to be, so I wasn't really working. I had, believe it or not, a motorhome, and I would have dressed casually and put some suits in the motorhome, and I could travel and go to where I needed to be if there were important meetings or to solicit funds. So that's what I was doing. And so from my mom's standpoint, though, I was unemployed, and technically I guess I was. So she was, you know, not less than thrilled about the
fact. She wanted the steady job and not chasing your dreams.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
She's a good mom. I like that.
Well, yeah. Fortunately, she lived into see our 20th plus anniversary at the radio station. So she was feeling pretty good about it by that time, but not at the beginning.
I bet so.
So how did it work when you envisioned owning the radio station to then owning it? Like, how different was that?
You mean the difference between the vision and the reality?
Yeah,
well, yeah, there's certainly some, you know, you have a reality check that comes about when you are getting into a business. And that was my first time to be involved in the ownership of a business, although I'd been around Universal Life Insurance Company and in that business. So I'd seen firsthand business ownership, but there are challenges, no question about it. And so both from the legal standpoint, accounting standpoint, you had to go, you're following the FCC, Federal Communications Commission. So there's very definite rules and regulations you have to follow. And I went to school, actually, I went to the University of Memphis. By that time, the school was more open. At one point, it had been a segregated institution, as you know. So I went out to the University of Memphis and took courses in, you know, radio, in media.
Oh, okay. So you learned along the way.
I did. Yeah, I really did. Because as I often say, if I'd known I was going to be in radio, I'd probably prepared myself a lot better than I did for being in that. But yes, I did learn along the way.
In the long term, what would you say was one of the key drivers of success for that business?
One of the key drivers, well, for me and the business, I think just perseverance was a key driver, you know, of success. I mean, as far as people who are looking to get into business, I think just staying the course, because you're going to have lots of ups and downs. So that was one driver. The radio business itself at that time was a fundamentally sound business. Media, as you know, has changed tremendously over the years. So that, you know, whereas once when I first got into radio, there may have been 10, 12, something in that range, radio signals in the Memphis market. Today, there are 40 plus. I don't even know how many, but there's lots of signals that reach Memphis. Same thing with television at that time, because when you're in the media, you're competing with all, you know, advertising mediums. So television, there were four stations. I believe there were the three major networks and the PBS. And now, who knows how many. I guess if you look at the TV, you know, listings, it could be 100 media outlets. I mean, there are just tons of stations, both radio and television. So the business itself has changed quite a bit. But the driver at the time was the fact that it was a good business, but you have had to adjust over the years to a changing marketplace.
You know, that makes me think about, because there are so many options now, who is your target audience at WLOK?
Well, you know, what that has given rise to the fact that there's so many options is niche marketing. And our target is 35 plus women, skewing heavily Black. And because we're a gospel station, our format is gospel music. So we are a community station that plays gospel music. So that format, it creates an audience which for us is 30 plus Black female, and it's a niche market that has a strong buying power. So what you're really doing is you're selling the buying power of whatever market you serve. But lots of the companies now have to go to a niche in terms of trying to find a place in the market.
So I would imagine a lot of radio stations are either trying to get a really broad audience or a really niche audience.
Well, you know, the history of radio is that years and years ago, I mean, many, many decades ago, radio was kind of a broad audience. But then when television came into being, radio changed so that it began to get the niche marketing early on, or niche audiences. So you'll have like your country station in radio, you'll have your pop station, you'll have your R&B station, you'll have your gospel station. I mean, you have all kinds of different stations. So the stations now, and this is more since the advent even of television, have gone to niche marketing and founding their niche. In fact, finding a way to survive initially at the time, and then it became music, and particularly, you know, specific types of music.
And you said it's a community radio station. Do you do community shows as opposed to just music on the radio?
Well, our primary format is music. When I say we're a community station, we reach out to our audience and try to do things that will be important informationally to the audience, psychologically, you know, to the audience in terms of just culturally. So we try to, you might say, super serve the audience that is our niche. And that is, it's a Black female audience that skews to over 30. And so most of the things we do skew to that audience. So when we're doing community things, we do so many community things. The picnic is one. It's a free event, but we do just lots and lots of community activities, from public service announcements to, you know, WLOK Black Film Festival. That's another area in which we expand it. So we try to reach out to our audience and really serve that audience.
Can you talk a little bit more about the film festival and what do you do and what's the
club? Sure. Well, the film festival is something we developed about 5 years ago. And what we do is take major films and show them, and we present them in different venues. And there are maybe six or so. It's a weekend of activity. And so we've developed it to the point now where there are about six or so films that we do. But we try to start out with a film that has significance culturally, historically. This year, we did Harriet. The story of Harriet Tubman, who was one of the leaders or conductors, as they call it, in the Underground Railroad, taking slaves north to freedom. So that was a poignant and significant movie. 2 years before, we had done Black Panther, which is similarly significant in its own, you know, manner. And so we do movies that have significance. Another movie we did was Just Mercy this year. Just Mercy was about a person who was convicted, Black man convicted in Alabama, and who was then represented and found to be innocent. And they have projects, I don't know if the Innocence Project was the specific one, but there are projects that deal with that subject. So after the films, we will sometimes have a discussion group, either in studio or on the radio, you know, about what's, you know, being brought out or what the issues are that are being discussed in the film.
Well, that's amazing. All three very good movies. So,
well, yeah, we've tried to get movies that have a, you know, special relevance. And then one that was particularly popular this year, in addition to Harriet, was a movie about Aretha Franklin. Aretha, it wasn't the movie about her. It was actually a documentary where she had recorded her first and only gospel album. It was the biggest selling gospel album of all time. So they had a live recording of it. So we went out to Crosstown Theater and presented that movie, and they have a fantastic sound system over there. So it was almost like being in church. I mean, people were responding to it, a lot of amens, right. And, you know, people up and, you know, shouting and all kinds of things that happen in the church. So that's, we try to get movies that are relevant, and that has been, again, another extension of what we do as far as WLOK is concerned.
It really is. And I know you can't do all of these things by yourself.
Absolutely not.
So how do you find and retain and recruit your best people?
Well, you know, one of the things we have to do is always be open to people coming in and to recruiting. I mean, you're always, you know, recruiting in a sense. And so you have to have, you know, an excellent staff to be able to do these things, and not just to do radio, just radio by itself. You know, it requires people who are excellent in their particular areas. So it's a matter of being open to people coming in, also being able to look at everybody who's there. You know, that when in the early years of radio, one of the things that gave us a competitive advantage is that radio was essentially a male-dominated industry. You know, whether you wanted to look at programming side, on the sales side, we were pretty much male-dominated. So that made me aware, hey, there's an opportunity here, because there were an awful lot of people that were coming in who were women, who were well-qualified. So we began hiring a number of women who otherwise might not have had the same opportunities in some of the radio stations. So that worked well. But I think the overall point is you have to be open to being able to hire the best available people to whatever you're doing. And so that's something that helped us tremendously in terms of recruitment. And then we do testing, and we do other things that to try to make sure that the people we hire are able to do, you know, the job that we have open.
How many employees do you have?
We have about 15 full-time, 15 equivalent, the full-time equivalent. We have a number of employees. Now, this is for the radio station. Then we have some others who do some things in the film aspect and in the Stone Soul Picnic. But basically, we are a company that's about 15 to 20 people altogether.
Do you have volunteers that do work at the radio station as
Not
well?
Not really. We do take interns, but when we take interns, they are from colleges. And actually, we have some from one or two that we take from a church. Well, there's one church here locally, Brown Missionary Baptist Church, that does an intern program. And it's been fortunate for us because we've taken interns from their program. And now two of our full-time employees are from Brown Baptist Church. Although they started with us as interns, that has been some years back. So we have a couple of employees that have come from internship programs. Well, one is from Brown, actually. The other was from Russ College. But we have another employee who also is a member of that church.
How did the idea of the film festival come about?
You know, we were looking at ways to expand. And we saw a void in terms of, I guess, from the cultural standpoint, that you didn't have really something that's specifically dealt with Black films. I mean, you have obviously a lot of films out there that are, you know, Black films are there either by virtue of having an actor or a director or just a subject matter. But there was not one place where, you know, you could put that together and create a weekend and have people, you know, have an opportunity to come and visit and see those movies and also comment on them. And like I said, we have, after some of the ones that are more significant socially, we'll have discussions. And so that gives people an opportunity to come together that wasn't otherwise necessarily available in the same way.
That's great. That really is. Tell me a little bit about the culture of your company.
Well, we are, I guess, a culture. We try to be open to ideas. I think at one time, this is years and years ago, we had someone did a study of our culture, and they had, you know, X, Y, Z, you know, they put these alphabets to them. But ultimately, what they concluded, and I can't remember what university it was from, but they wanted to do a study, was that we were a more open, you know, culture in terms of trying to allow people to, you know, be able to have input. So it was a more of a free exchange in that sense. So we also have a culture that, because we are a Black-oriented station and Black-owned station, that our culture is something that essentially we try to do things that are going to be helpful and meaningful in terms of our community, not just the Black community, but also working from that base to try to help bring about positive things for the entire community. So that's another part of our culture, a little bit different aspect of our culture, but we have that as a part of our culture too.
What's the best decision that you've made in regard to your business?
Well, getting into it, just making the decision to do the business and to move into the business, I think that was a positive decision. It turned out to be, you know, a good decision. I don't know. I think that we're always looking and searching, so just being open to ideas. But I probably the biggest decision was just the fact of actually reaching out, because there was quite an effort involved in trying to put together the financing and just making the decision to go forward. Because at the time we did that, there were, you know, a lot of naysayers. And so the decision was, hey, you know, we're going to do this and we can do this and just going forward.
What would you say was the hardest part along the way?
Probably the financing. Because, you know, with radio, you buy the station first, so you pay for the station, then you operate it. Or you make the arrangement to pay. In this case, in our case, they wanted a cash, you know, arrangement because the company was leaving the radio business. And so they were selling several stations. So the financing of it was probably the most difficult. And that's why I said earlier, I was going around the country in different places and talking to different financial institutions or about the possibility of developing the financing for the station. So I would say that was the most difficult part. And then, of course, you're always looking to, as we said earlier, get good people. But that's not so much difficult, but it's something you have to be able to focus on and allow opportunities, you know, for people to come in. But I wouldn't call it a difficult part.
Did you have any advisors or mentors that helped you? Because that's kind of it's not what you studied. So
right.
Did you have anybody that you could really help guide you?
My dad was probably my best mentor. And although he was not involved in radio, and he passed away before I got into the radio business, but I think that the foundation that was laid in my home and with my dad was probably the best advice because, you know, whatever I might do, you know, when you have, I guess, a more fundamental, you know, underpinnings advice, then that has a very positive impact. So I would say my dad was my biggest, you know, advisor and mentor. But also, as I mentioned earlier, I was working at Universal Life Insurance Company, and just the fact of having that company there made me more aware of what was possible. Because, we were in a segregated society, but Universal was a Black-owned company. And so the people that were there, Maceo Walker was one who was there. My dad worked there, of course, as well. And so the people who were there at the company were people who were, I would consider, mentors, even though it wasn't specifically in the field of radio.
Hmm. Talking about business ownership and being just a leader.
And business, and just in general, and people. And I mean, just the kinds of things that are common to whatever business that you might happen to be doing.
If you could go back in time and give yourself some advice as you were starting the company or taking over, what would you say to yourself?
Well, I think that my mom would have said, don't do it. So I guess my advice would be, you know, try to...
Don't listen to your mom?
I think you have to just kind of, you know, stay the course of what you believe in doing. But the advice I would really give myself would be just continue. I feel good about the way that it happened, what I did do. So I don't know that I would necessarily do it differently. You make mistakes along the way. So certainly at one point, the advice I would give myself in terms of after it had gotten started and we were doing well was expanding out. So I think we expanded a little bit too fast and tried to go into some other markets. So the advice I would give myself would be in terms, it wasn't for the, at the beginning, but a little bit after the beginning, a few years later, was to lay your base and foundation in a firmer way before you start trying to expand too much. So I think that's something that we did. That was a mistake that we made. And so that would be the area that I would say I would do something a little bit differently.
If somebody came and said, Art, I think I'm going to start a radio station, what would you say to those people?
Well, if they're going to start a business at all, first of all, I would say, you know, do something you really enjoy doing, you like doing, and then that you're going to do all aspects of the business. In other words, if you, whatever that business is, to me, you should be willing to do whatever the elements are in that business yourself. And so that would be one. Number two, I would say make sure you have a good lawyer and make sure you have a good accountant because you're going to need them. So that would be another aspect. Over time, you'll need both and from the beginning, really.
Very good advice and very important information for sure.
As a matter of fact, Pearson, one of the things I did, you know, some few years ago, you may or may not remember, but I talked to you and talked to the Society of Entrepreneurs, you as a part of that, about accounting and trying to determine, you know, whether there might be an accounting. And I was just trying to determine what firms were part of the society and involved and that could be recommended. So I think you have to reach out, not just to the society, but in general to other, you know, business people, peers in business to get information and to try to get their points of view. So things like that, the society itself has been very helpful in terms of being able to have someone to bounce things off of. I wouldn't say there's so much mentors, but just people in business to, you know, look at and have someone that you feel you can pick up the phone and call and say, hey, here's something I've got and tell me what you think about it.
Well, it's going to be lonely at the top, so it's nice to have somebody to talk to.
It really is. It's very, very important to be able to do that.
You know, talking about that and entrepreneurs and that it is lonely at the top, one of the questions we always ask in these interviews is, do you think that being an entrepreneur is something that you can learn, or is it taught, or are you born that way?
I think both. I mean, I think you have to learn the particulars of the business that you're in, but I believe there's a certain, an edge maybe that entrepreneurs have. In other words, an entrepreneur is a risk taker. And if you're not inclined to do that, then I would say you don't want to be an entrepreneur. And also the people who are taking risks like that are usually have a certain level of confidence, you know, about it. So there's a little bit of an edge, you know, there. But as I think I mentioned to you the other day, I was talking at you know, one of our meetings, and that is that the advice I got, the best advice I think I got was, you're as good as anybody else, but you're not better than anybody else. So I think that to a certain extent, to me, that's an entrepreneur has to understand that. You have to have that confidence. If you don't have the confidence, it's going to be a little tough. So you might just want to stay at a desk and, you know, take your check in. But you also can't, I think, have an arrogance. So you want to understand that you're not better than anyone else, but you're as good as anybody.
And who gave you that advice?
My mom and my dad. My mom in particular.
Who also told you not to buy the radio station.
Right, exactly. <Yeah. laughs> Well, she had some points that she yes. made that were very good.
And some that we just ignore. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
I love you, Mom, but... Well, I want to get back to talking about Memphis because yes. I think it is, and it's a very unique environment, and you've talked a little bit about how things have changed. What excites you about Memphis and what concerns you about Memphis?
Well, I think Memphis has changed so much for the better. I mean, since I was a youngster, and I think the future of Memphis is great. So that aspect of it is important. What concerns me, not so much about Memphis per se, but about the country as a whole, Memphis being a part of that. But maybe even in some other places, you see it even more so than in Memphis, but is the divisiveness in the country and the what you call the so-called left and the so-called right and people who don't just disagree but seem to hate each other. And so I think that's a concern, not just in Memphis, but throughout the country. And so I think that, you know, when you see, to my view, something like what happened on January 6th in the United States and what amounts to an insurrection, and then you have two sides on that and people very much poles apart. And I think those things concern me about Memphis and about the country as a whole.
What do you think we can do about it?
You know, one of the things that ultimately in matters of this kind, when people aren't listening to each other, one side wins. I mean, it appears the ideal thing we could do about it would be to come together and compromise and to try to work things out in a way where it's a win-win. But sometimes you get into situations where there's not a win-win and where you have to try to do those things that are going to be what you believe are in the best interest of the country. Unfortunately, in a way, both sides seem to think they're doing what's in the best interest of the country. But I think that in an ideal world, we'd be able to talk to each other and come to some agreements and recognize that there's a common good, that what happens to one person in this city or in this country is going to happen to others. It's not like one side's going to take charge and the others are not going to be affected. Or, you know, if the country has problems, everyone in the country, you know, has problems. If the country succeeds, everyone succeeds. So I think trying to come together is what would be best. In some ways, Memphis has been able to come together a little more than some places have, but there's a lot to be done, you know, here in Memphis. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that you have such disparity, particularly economic disparities in Memphis. So the biggest issues to me in Memphis are the economic disparities. And if those don't get addressed, I think you're still going to continue to have problems beneath the surface and on the surface many times as well.
So Memphis is known to have one of the biggest charitable philanthropic cultures.
Yes.
Are you involved with the nonprofits in the community?
Oh, yeah. I serve on a number of nonprofits. You know, I've had over the years served on nonprofits. So yes.
Do you see any organizations that are particularly having an impact on Memphis along the lines of what you're talking about?
You know, I think that, yes, there are several individual nonprofits that in my mind do have some impact. But ultimately, I think the problems that we see in Memphis and around the country are too big for individual nonprofits. I mean, these are things that governments have to deal with. So if you're going to say Build Back Better, as Biden's, you know, the Build Back Better effort, I mean, that's not something a nonprofit, that's something the government has to do if they're going to do it. And then also, I mean, even just the infrastructure bill, that's something that's current now. And it has passed. So while I think the nonprofits do affect individual communities, I think a nonprofit can do a great job saying, you can have a nonprofit goes into, say, Orange Mound or some other, some community, and they can do things that help the communities. I think that's important. But to me, the challenges that we have are big enough that you have to have fundamental involvement of government to rectify what in many ways has been a historical injustice or things that have historically occurred in the Memphis community and around the country.
Yeah, I think that it just seems like there's no toleration for somebody that doesn't see the worldview as the same as you.
Yeah, you have an awful lot of that. I mean, again, in Congress, you're having people who are fighting. I mean, who are seriously fighting each other. I mean, not just differences of point of view. And we just, recently, I guess just in the last couple of days before this interview, Bob Dole passed away. And Bob Dole's Republican, and so you look at that. But when you look at who he was, what he stood for trying to bring people together across party lines. And in Memphis, we need to do that across racial lines and to try to, again, rectify, in my view, things that are the result of our history. It's not that there's so much that people today are actively involved in things that have caused us problems over, historically, but the history can't be undone, but it can be hopefully addressed in some other ways, but can't undo history. But that's, to me, that is the key issue. And to answer your question initially, though, yes, nonprofits, I think, can have a significant role in that. But the problem is so massive that I think it only government can really address it fully.
I thought that you were going to have like the answer, Art. I'm kind of sad.
Not today. I don't know what that answer is, to tell you the truth. But I think we can all be, optimistic and try to work toward making this a better place.
Listening and respect. It's all about respect, you know?
It is. I mean, I think that, people are going to have differences, of opinion. But that doesn't mean they have to hate each other. And to me, a lot of what we see today is people, and on a national level, I mean, that's something I would not have guessed. As I mentioned earlier, I went to Washington. I was there for a year. And that was a different Washington than you see today. So, and I don't know that you have in Memphis as much of the vitriol as you do even on a national level.
Well, that's kind of good to hear.
Well, I think it is. I think in many ways we are able to move forward on some fronts without fighting each other. But I think a lot of it, though, frankly, has been the fact that Memphis has, over the years, had a greater involvement and opportunity for the Black community to be able to be represented in government and in everything else in Memphis. So that if that were not the case, I think Memphis would be like so many other places are, where you have these huge differences and people clashing and not being able to talk with each other. But I think that Memphis has been fortunate in the sense that, whereas when I was a youngster, you had no Black representation at all. I mean, not government, not police, not even in educational institutions. That has changed, and Memphis is a majority Black city. And I think that has proven to be a plus in the sense that it is moving forward without having the same levels of conflict that we used to have back when, in the period when you had the I Am a Man and the Martin Luther King here. And so I think we've moved forward a lot from that period.
Maybe we've been forced to do some other work that other cities haven't been forced to do yet.
We have been forced to do that. And I think just the sheer political aspect of Memphis, the Memphis politics of Memphis, I think has been, in a sense, I won't say it has saved Memphis, but it certainly helped Memphis avoid some of the issues that I see in some other cities where you don't have, I guess you might say, representative government or representative policing, and you have so much conflict. And I mean, you've seen that. We've seen that all over the country.
And you turn on the TV and you can't miss it, can you?
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
So what do you do for fun personally?
Well, I like movies, Haven't been, you know, COVID has stopped that a little bit, but I enjoy movies. I enjoy a quiet time, like the beach. So my wife, Dorit, and I will go to the beach. We just came back from Destin, Florida. And so, but mostly I enjoy, you know, what I do professionally. But yeah, I also enjoy, you know, that quiet time of being able to, you know, enjoy a movie, go to the beach and do things of that type.
Think you're ever going to retire?
You know, I don't really envision that. You know, I enjoy what I'm doing, and so I don't. But I do envision trying to get to a situation where what we have developed with our company can go forward, because we're a small company. And so that means that, you know, in order to be able to go forward, we have to be able to develop the skills, the talent, and new people coming in. So I hope to be able to, quote, retire, but at the same time, maybe be a mentor or maybe be a help to others who are moving the business forward. And when I can see that that's going to happen, then I go to Destin and just stay there.
Sounds like a pretty good plan to me, for sure. Yes. Well, this has really been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it, Art, and I'm so thankful for you and all that you do in this community.
Well, I thank you. I appreciate coming in. And also, as I said earlier, you know, I'm pleased to be a part of the Society of Entrepreneurs. And it's really been a resource, you know, from my standpoint, not just sort of an honor, it's something to acknowledge as an award or anything, but it's really been something that, from a practical standpoint, has been a resource. And I've appreciated being able to talk to the people who are other members of the Society. Of course, to you, Pearson, who you keep us all in line. And so that's really good. But it's been important. So I'm always happy to be a part of anything that the Society is doing.
Excellent. Great insights.
We certainly appreciate it. Yes, for sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. We hope that you enjoyed our interview with Art Gilliam. If you'd like to learn more about Art or WLOK, please visit our show notes.